Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. After another wild night of Champions League football, we have our first two semi-finalists, PSG and Barcelona, into the semi-finals, but not without a whole lot of drama and not without making it a little bit difficult for themselves. My name is Jack Collins and I will be your host today. And Dean Jones is flying across the Atlantic. So I've had to call in some podcast royalty, some sports podcast royalty, all the way across the other side of the Atlantic. Delighted to say I'm joined by the one and only Mike Zimmerman. How you doing, mate? It's so good to have you here on Ranks FC.
My man, Jack, I appreciate the call, man. I woke up at 6 a.m. this morning, saw the text, and started off my day really well. Thanks so much for having me.
No, it's a real pleasure. Like, Mike and I have worked together for a long time across a variety of different things. This man is a producer extraordinaire, broadcaster extraordinaire, and I'm excited to sit down and chat about these two games with you, Mike. I mean, I think the point here that we could probably start with before we get into them individually is that both PSG and Barcelona were big favourites coming into tonight. They are the two favourites to go and win the Champions League outright. And there wasn't loads, it felt like, of jeopardy for either of them. A little bit more for PSG having to go to Villa Park, but Barcelona felt like they were almost through. Now, both of them have got through, but it did feel like perhaps they took their foot off the gas a little bit too much in terms of whether these ties were done or not.
It felt like coming into tonight that both teams had, you know, taken care of business at home. It seemed like that Barcelona, sitting Pedri coming into the game, felt like maybe they had a little more going forward than PSG, just because going, like you said, going to Villa Park's a little more difficult, especially only up by two goals. But I think it was more of a mentality thing than anything, because we can come out of here saying, ooh, you know, both teams barely got through. But I think it was a mentality thing. I think Luis Enrique, I think Hansi Flick are going to have their clubs ready to go in the semifinal. I don't think it's going to be much of a scare. I think tonight's results are more of a reflection on Dortmund and Villa than they are on PSG and Barcelona.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And let's start with this game. Aston Villa 3, PSG 2, which meant that the game ended 5-4 to PSG on aggregate. And look, in the first half, one of the things you're sort of waiting and listening to bits before the game, one of the things that kind of struck me was every single Villa fan saying, we just can't concede first. If we concede first, this is done and dusted. There is no way we're going to score four and get through against this team. And look, that proved to be the case. They didn't score four, but they concede with Achraf Hakimi coming in and picking up an Emi Martinez spill. And it was a lightning break from PSG that opens this whole thing up. And the cross comes in and Hakimi's there to tidy it up. The cross comes in down that left. And that kind of is where I thought that PSG were going to get joy tonight. Matty Cash playing at right back in that role. We saw him struggle in the first day against Fiacre Kvaratskhelia, and it didn't matter who was going to be flying down that flank. You were a little bit worried for Villa. We saw De Zassi come on at halftime. He struggled as well. I wondered if Ezri Konsa might get the nod, but Matty Cash gets that, and suddenly he's marauding forward, and there are gaps for PSG to exploit. And this happens for the first goal. The ball comes across. Maybe Emi Martinez should do a little bit better. Questionable. I think it's a bit of a mix up in the box. But that's kind of like, ooh, big moment. And then sort of 15 minutes later, the almost exact opposite goal happens in that PSG marauded forward down the right, another break, and the ball comes in and Nuno Mendes strikes home. And you're like, wow, okay, the fullbacks are really going for it tonight. And at that point, you're looking at the tie going, okay, it's currently 5-1 on aggregate. This really doesn't look comfortable from a Villa perspective. And at that point, I think my question was, what do Villa do here? Now, Youri Tielemans scores before halftime, which kind of opens it up a little bit. And more than anything, I think it gets the stadium going a little bit, where it had fallen completely silent, apart from that PSG drum, which didn't shut up for the entire game. But you're kind of looking at it and thinking, okay, even at 5-2 on aggregate halftime, what is Unai Emery saying to them? Because they've been opened up twice on the counter already. They're going to have to go for it because they're going to try and have to score three goals over the course of this second half. And yet, if you go gung-ho against this PSG side, they're going to open you up. Now, I don't know what he said, but it worked. And suddenly, Matty Cash was the best one-on-one defender the world has ever seen. Yes, okay, Villa got away with a couple of scrapes when there were balls over the top, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's fine. But the way that they take control of this second half, the impetus on the press, which had been missing a little bit, I think that pressure on the ball high up to try and expose that, you know, stop them exposing that back line, all came in. John McGinn scores, slightly lucky, but you know, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, strike that takes a little deflection, loops over Donnarumma. And then a minute later, Ezri Konsa scores. And there is this one goal in it, all of a sudden, Villa Park is absolutely rocking and Villa have all the ascendancy. Couple of brilliant saves from Gigi Donnarumma, keeps PSG ahead in the tie. And then they gain a little bit more control. They just calm it down a little bit and the way that they kind of rest it back, very impressive in its own right. But even still, there is an opportunity late on. Marco Asensio has one where he goes through and you're thinking Narrative FC is going to absolutely strike here. And then Ian Martsen has one blocked on the line by William Pacho right at the death, just as it looked as if it was going to go to extra time. I mean, kind of looking at that as the way the game played out, I'm intrigued by a couple of things. I'm intrigued by the fact that Villa were able to suddenly up the ante in terms of their pressure on the ball by so much in that second half. I'm intrigued a little bit by the fact that PSG, for the first time in a long time, looked at a bit of sixes and sevens under the pressure and under the environment that was happening. And we've not really seen that. Now, PSG teams in the past would have crumbled, I think, on the back of what happened tonight, and they didn't, and they deserve immense credit for being able to just calm the game down, cool it off a little bit, and just quieten the crowd a bit while they knock the ball about, just to try and take a little bit of the sting out of the game. But I think teams will look at that and say, okay, that's how you play PSG. That's how you have to play PSG to stop them getting that ball over the top. And look, they still have opportunities. You're not going to ever stop them completely because they have that double thing going down both sides with Hakimi and whichever winger is playing on the right and then Nuno Mendes and whichever winger is playing on the left. Doesn't really matter. They're all over the place. I'm just kind of a little bit shook by the fact that Villa were that good from a position in the game. That PSG were in complete control from 5-1 up, four goals up in the tie. And I wonder if that's the comparison we can draw to Barcelona. Do PSG potentially take their foot a little bit off the gas once they score those first two goals?
I would say yes, but again, you have to give credit to Villa. And I think the thing that kind of sparked this semi-comeback is that Tielemans goal before halftime, because that, like you said, allowed Unai Emery to say, you know what, we have to go for it. And them pressing so hard in the midfield to dispossess João Neves and Vitinha was incredible. I think that was the key for Villa getting back, getting in opportunities. But that is a double-edged sword, as you say. I don't know if that's the blueprint to beat PSG going forward. I think Villa had to do that in order to get back into it, whereas going into a fresh semifinal, I don't know if you can do that from the start, because you do that and you don't get the ball off that midfield. Even Fabian Ruiz, you get the ball off of them in the midfield, you open up some opportunities for yourself to score. If you don't, though, you leave so much space for, like you said, whoever's flying down the left or right wing, wherever Dembele is roaming around has tons of space. So I think it's a risky strategy. I think Villa didn't have any other choice but to do that, and it worked out very well for them. I don't know moving forward if that is the blueprint to beat PSG.
Just in terms of that, I suppose, you know, obviously your Liverpool were knocked out by this PSG side in the previous round. And one of the things I was kind of looking at was the way that PSG dominated that home leg and ended up losing 1-0. the kind of flip of that was that Liverpool were much better in the second leg and they end up losing the game 1-0. So look, things can happen in football, right?
Sure.
But there was that aggressiveness to the way that Liverpool started at Anfield where chances were carved out. And I was talking earlier this week with a variety of sort of people about kind of French football who have their claws into French football about what PSG, what would PSG be worried about this tie? And they were like, well, not on paper, not on the fact that they are 3-1 up and they have the ability to go and score against anyone and they had the extra week off after the game. But they will know that in the back of every fan's mind is the fact that big leads and leads where they've been expected to sail through have fallen away from them before at, you know, at random moments, but at big moments as well, where a PSG side have been accused of bottling it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is a new crop, a new generation under Luis Enrique, and they don't have the same scar tissue, perhaps, as the teams that have gone beforehand. But I do think it's interesting that there was that moment and there is that double goal, obviously the John McGinn one. And then a minute later, Ezri Konsa scores. Some brilliant work from Marcus Rashford, by the way, to set that goal up. But the fact that those two goals are hit in quick succession and suddenly this game from being completely dead is completely alive again. I wonder if that will sit with PSG fans. I wonder if that will worry them or they'll take heart from the fact that PSG were able to kind of steady the ship after that moment and actually, you know, calm things down to a point of being able to control the game again.
Well, yeah, you could have easily saw them crumble and say, okay, that's what did them in. We've seen this before. It's the same script over and over again. But the fact that they, after that Konsa goal went in, it almost seemed like PSG took control back. Almost that they... The lackadaisical attitude coming in to the game was kind of over now because they needed to turn it on. And I think that final Villa goal really, it put more control into the game. I think it allowed them to slow the game down. We saw, what was it, the final 5 minutes or so was just throw-ins and slowing it down and just doing whatever it can to waste some time. I think PSG need to, I think they did learn how to do that. They may have needed to learn how to do that because they haven't had to do that all season, especially in Ligue 1. But this is something that I think Luis Enrique's team, especially with it being so young, needed to learn how to manage a game. And that's something that I think we'll talk about a little bit later is Barcelona kind of failed to do. They didn't manage that game against Dortmund. Whereas I think PSG towards the end of that game realized what they needed to do to get over the line. And they did that. Now it wasn't pretty, but I think you can take solace in that. Maybe this PSG team knows how to win. Maybe, you know, this was a growing pain that they needed to experience because domestically they hadn't. And I think you can look at it and say, okay, maybe this hurdle was needed in order for them to get further than anything else.
Yeah, I think one of the things probably we should flip to with Aston Villa was the physicality that was used in this midfield, right? So you take Youri Tielemans out of it for a minute because he kind of played a central role and he's the kind of architect in the middle there. But you start with a midfield of Morgan Rodgers on the right, Boubacar Kamara and Amadou Inanna holding deep, John McGinn nominally playing on the left, whether he was actually there or not is not actually really the case. And then Marcus Rashford trying to stretch in behind and play up front. Now, that was a controversial decision in itself that he gets the nod over Ollie Watkins, but the way he played in Konsa for that third goal probably justifies that selection within itself. But I do wonder if this is a thing. You know, we've talked and I've talked throughout the course of this season about how much I adore this PSG midfield, the technicality of it, the, you know, the Vitinha João Neves thing with the kind of intensity that Neves brings to the table and the control that Vitinha brings to almost any team. And, you know, I think he had more passes than the entire Villa midfield in the first leg and more completed passes too. Fabian Ruiz, kind of the older head in there, but perhaps the forgotten man sometimes with the emergence of these two great little Portuguese talents. And I wonder if just the fact that in the second half, we saw a little bit of a change in terms of Villa went more aggressive into that middle zone. They you know, this was obviously Emery's game plan from the start. And it wasn't like they lost the midfield battle in the first half. They were just undone by two incredibly quick breaks. I don't know if people will look at that and think, okay, if we're going to stop this PSG midfield, we cannot we cannot outplay them with the ball. It's almost impossible. Maybe Barcelona will have something to say about that. But generally, I think no one is going to look at that and say, yeah, we'll just get the ball off them and we'll pass it around them. It just doesn't happen. But the way that Villa set up with the physicality in there and a little bit more of kind of, okay, we'll probably launch a few goal kicks longer. We'll try and win those midfield flick-ons. We're going to try and win those that battle from an aerial and a physical perspective. I am quite intrigued to see if other teams try to kind of stack that midfield in the same way, because they know that they can't go through it. Can they almost go over it?
Okay, so then potentially it would Real Madrid or Arsenal. Do you think either one of those would pack the midfield? I think Madrid can certainly do that. I don't know if Arsenal have the legs to do that in the midfield. I don't know.
Just imagine Arsenal going for the kind of option of going, okay, we'll play Marino up top. In fact, quite similar to what they did with the Real Madrid game in the first game. Marino drops down into the diamond. You have Rice in there. You have Partey in there. And okay, you have Martin Odegaard, who's a little bit more of a creative type. But, you know, the way that Declan Rice drove through the Real Madrid midfield, sure. I wonder if that's something that Arsenal will probably look to and be like, okay, we definitely can't beat them by knocking it about them. Can we have Declan driving through the middle of this? And is that going to be a sort of a game plan that we could potentially go to?
Well, because I don't know if Arsenal do sit deep, I don't know if they have that counterattacking threat besides Saka. And we don't even know if he's 100% healthy. I'm sure he will start.
I'm sure he'll be fine. But
again, I wouldn't necessarily call him that counterattacking threat, especially if you're sitting, if you're going 5-4-1 maybe. You know, I don't know if he's that outlet. So it is difficult. I do think to beat PSG, you need to get the ball off of them in the midfield. You can't just absorb pressure and let them run the show, especially Vitinha playing deep as well. He's a smaller player in that holding midfielder role, which is, it's so impressive. All he does is spray balls all over the place. Very similar to, you know, to an Andre Pirlo, where he's not really going to break up play. He's more just going to run the show on the ball than off the ball.
I'm quite intrigued by lots of things, right? But one of them is the idea of how do you stop this PSG side from scoring? Because even in defeat tonight, you know, they've scored another two goals on top of everything else. Both goals have come from the fullbacks. If the front three aren't tearing you apart, Vitinha can shoot from distance.
Sure.
And then you've got Nuno Mendes flying down one side and Hakimi flying down the other. And it becomes almost at times, I think, a front five. Now, perhaps that leaves them a little bit exposed from a counter-attacking perspective. And if it was Real Madrid to go through, you'd kind of assume that they were going to be able to maybe get in those gaps and take advantage of some of the spaces that Villa picked up tonight. I don't know how many other teams are going to have the capability to do that in the same kind of way. And when you are trying to defend this front five, as it kind of ends up being sometimes, with Vitinha sitting behind and just being like, oh, don't give me the ball on the edge, I will shoot. And I might not score, but it'll bounce in there somewhere and we'll see how we go. It feels like it's impossible to stop them from getting at goal. And look, they were in a great game tonight, and I think Villa were deserved winners on the night. I think probably the better team has gone through over the course of the two legs. But even in that, even in defeat, you look at the kind of stats that have been racked up. They racked up 14 shots and 7 on target. We saw moments for Desiré Doué towards the end, who came off the bench. Only substitution, by the way, which I thought was an interesting mark from Luis Enrique. You saw, you know, moments at the end for Dembele. I think they put the ball in the net twice. That both were called correctly offside, but it's almost impossible to stop them creating chances. And I wonder if there is just an element, and look, part of the reason I would love to see a PSG against Barcelona final in this competition is because I think it could be 5-4. Because I think that both sides would be like, we are giving no quarter to the way we want to play football. And that can open things up. And it does make me think that, you know, what Villa did there in the second half, where they just went, right, we're going to have to try and outgun you, might be the only way to actually stand up to this PSG attacking force.
Oh, it's ironic that we're talking about kind of the two favorites in Barcelona and PSG, where I think the only way to beat PSG is to have more possession, because that's the only way to stop them. And I think the only team that can probably do that is Barcelona, yet PSG may allow Barcelona to have more of the ball because they play such a high line. And you feel like you can get any one of those front three or five running in behind. We saw it many times tonight against Dortmund, where, you know, who knows if Balde is going to be healthy. Koundé doesn't have the pace to keep up. They are susceptible to players running in behind. and PSG probably have the best front three pace of any team remaining. Yeah. So it's very weird that that Barcelona are probably the only club that can keep possession from PSG, yet playing with that high line might be a downfall. So it is very weird. I think the only way to beat PSG is holding that ball, keeping possession for a sustained period of time. Yet the only team that can probably do that plays an absurdly high line and
might play into PSG's hands at the same time.
It would be a fascinating final if we do get there, because it certainly seems like the strengths and weaknesses play into each other's hands.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's come on to Barcelona. That game was brilliant within itself. So we'll turn to the game at the Westfalenstadion after a quick break. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. Jack Collins and Mike Zimmerman alongside you. And we're flipping over to Germany to talk about Borussia Dortmund 3, Barcelona 1. Barcelona's first loss in 2025, Mike. Now, an aggregate win, 5-3, maybe makes that think that it's not such a big deal. But this wasn't comfortable from Barcelona's perspective from the off, I thought. And actually, the way that Borussia Dortmund to have struggled this season, yes, they had a good result in the Clásica, a fight back against Bayern earlier in the weekend, and now have put together a very, very impressive performance here. Perhaps this is a turning point for them. From a Barcelona perspective, this is the first time that anyone has really, really exposed this high line to this degree.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes down to the lack of control in the midfield for Barcelona, especially with Pedri sitting for about, 70 minutes or so. And ideally, you would have, as a Barcelona side, perspective, you would have preferred Pedri sitting for a full 90. Without him on the pitch, Barcelona have some possession issues. And when you're a high-press team with that high back line, you need to maintain possession of that ball. Otherwise, you are going to get bit. And we saw that so many times against Dortmund. We've seen that from time to time domestically in La Liga, but not to this extent. And I think, especially with Inigo Martinez not playing, that lack of leadership was a huge hole. I thought Araujo didn't play as well as he could have. I think Cubarsí, as fantastic of a player as he is still 18 years old. He is young. And I think the lack of pace on the fullbacks was jarring. I think Koundé is out of place a lot of the times and is bailed out by his center halves. I think without Alejandro Balde, I think Gerard Martin did okay, but he was bit on the counter as well.
He struggled a bit all season long. He feels like the one La Masia product who's been thrown into this and hasn't quite hit the heights that everyone else has, I think.
And that's the thing. If Balde isn't healthy, where he'll make up for pace, he can recover. I have some concerns with them allowing goals. Now, will they just outscore the opponent by 2 or 3 goals? Sure. That could easily happen with their firepower up front. But with the better teams you play, it's going to be a little more difficult to break them down as well. So, for instance, Bayern or Inter, are you going to be able to score easily on them? I don't know, because Rafinha, Lewandowski, and Lamine Yamal didn't really do much against Dortmund. How are they going to fare against teams set up better defensively? I think it all came down to control, because they weren't able to get those outlet passes to their front three, especially to the two wingers. Once Pedri came on, things seemed to calm down just a little, and then Dortmund scored that third goal and things kind of got a little crazy again. But for the most part, I think once Pedri came on, things got a little more under control. And the problem is, though, if you're relying on one player to control the whole game, that can leave some holes, especially in transition. So overall, I think Barcelona over the two legs were probably the better team. Yeah. I think they were just superbly better in that first leg, which allowed them to go through, and they needed every one of those goals, especially that last that fourth goal, that Lamine Yamal goal in that first leg. They desperately needed that So I think Hansi Flick can be proud of his team. I think there are some things to fix in the midfield, especially if it is Frankie de Jong playing in that sixth role. And it seems like he's kind of cemented his place in there ahead of Casado. I think that they need to figure out, maybe Koundé doesn't go forward as much as we would like, which is a shame because him and Lamine Yamal have really developed a nice duo on that right flank. But you might have to do that in order to solidify that back line because it was wide open against Dortmund. And it's only going to get worse if you don't figure out those problems against either Bayern or Inter.
Yeah, I've kind of contrasting views on this. I do think that when Alejandro Balde is there on the left-hand side, Koundé tucks in a little bit more. Yes, he has the ability to get forward and combine and connect. And I think that's interesting. But it's almost like, oh, we don't have that outlet on the left at the moment, so I better get forward on the right. And it opened up spaces. In Gerard Martinez is not as comfortable a defender as Koundé is on the other side. It kind of looked off balance. Now, I think there's two things here. One is that if this is against Bayern, I think that Barcelona will find a way because that defensive line doesn't look particularly comfortable at the moment. The injuries have hit Bayern hard. If this is Inter, well, this is not miles off the setup, right? And actually, what was interesting watching this game tonight was seeing Rafinha, Lewandowski and Lamine Yamal, as you kind of alluded to, not being able to feed into those normal channels that they seem to operate in. And what that meant, the three centre-backs that Borussia Dortmund put in here, was that they were able to basically be like, okay, we're going to put the centre-backs here. We're going to just sort of tuck the wing-backs in for a long time and just allow them to make sure that no one is getting those overloads. We can double up on these wide players. There isn't a major threat coming in from left-back. And that allowed this front three to stay really high. Now, this is the front three I expected to start the first leg. Maxi Bayer starting in front of Jamie Gittins, just because the way that he gets in behind as a kind of number nine converted to a wider player tends to be spaces that you're looking at and you're thinking, okay, if he can operate in those spaces, then suddenly Borussia Dortmund are going to get in behind more and more and more. And yes, okay, there wasn't enough pressure on the ball from a Barcelona perspective, which has been one of the kind of hallmarks of this high line and why it's worked so well across the course of the season. But Girassi picks up a hat trick here. I thought the Bayer was excellent. I thought that Adeyemi caused problems at the same time. And once you started seeing that, it was like, okay, it's now 3-on-3 a lot of the time. And we're just going to lump them over and see where you get to. And that, for me, felt like the kind of game plan that I would operate if I had to come up against this Barcelona team right now. Now, that's the game plan that Inter are going to operate. Now, they'll get the wing-backs a little bit further forward, I think, than what Borussia Dortmund did across the course of this evening. But generally, you're looking at it and thinking, yeah, that's kind of the modus operandi that Inzaghi is going to play. And that, for me, is a slight concern when you know how good Inter are from a defensive perspective for Barcelona.
Yeah, I agree. I think that if it is Bayern, I think Barca would find a way because I think, as you mentioned, Bayern backline not too convincing at the moment. And I think that Bayern would want to play and come out, leaving space open for Barca. I think Inter is perfectly fine with sitting back and, you know, letting that front two of Lautaro Martinez and Thuram hover around that back line, see what they can make happen. I do think that another thing that Barcelona need to be concerned about is their lack of height on set pieces. I think that hasn't bitten them too much this season.
Yeah, but it's often Lewandowski clearing it at the front post or nothing.
Well, that's the thing, because their center backs don't necessarily have height, especially when it's Martinez and Kubarsi back there. They don't have anybody who's going to dominate in the air. And that could be a concern. Again, it hasn't bitten them, but it's there for the taking. It just seems that nobody has taken advantage of that yet. And again, we are in the semifinals of the Champions League, so we are kind of nitpicking here. But if there are weaknesses in this Barcelona team, I think those are them. I think it's defensively on probably behind the fullbacks and their height on set pieces defending.
Just to come on to Fermín López, I've been a huge proponent of his for a long time, and he's a player I really like. His work ethic is exceptional. He gets around, he makes things happen, and he's a busy bee in there. And I think often, another of those La Masia products, he kind of gets forgotten in there, that he is technically very, very gifted at the same time. He plays in the 10 here, which is a role that Dani Olmo has picked up a lot of the time. He did okay, and obviously he forces the goal that ultimately seals this game. You know, once Barcelona go up and score, it kind of felt like job done at that point. Even after Borussia Dortmund scored again, I never really felt like Barcelona were going to ship another two off the back of that. But Fermín also had a lot of gilt-edged chances that fell to him in sort of areas that you'd expect Dani Olmo to be recently. He's been the kind of fix-it guy. He's the guy you want in short situations in the box where there's not that much space and magic feet can make something happen, etc., etc. Fermín just felt like he was a little bit loose in those areas and a little bit loose with his finishing when Barcelona really... You know, obviously the goal eventually came, but if they'd scored that goal in the first half, this tie would have felt effectively dead from that moment.
I think Fermín López will give you more than Dani Olmo in terms of energy, running around defensively, trying to pick off passes, putting pressure on the opponent. I think Dani Olmo links up better with that front three. It seems to have more of an understanding and a more fluid attack. So I think for Hansi Flick, I think it's all about what do you want in that number 10 against your next opponent. Do you want that link between the front three and De Jong and Pedri? Or do you want somebody who's going to continue to be that disruptive presence in the midfield, trying to win that ball back? I tend to lean more towards Dani Olmo just because I think what we saw against Dortmund, the almost non-existent play of that front three, is kind of concerning. And you need that extra link. Whereas maybe in the league, you don't necessarily need that. I think going into a Champions League semifinal, I think you need that extra link between the midfield and that front three instead of that player disrupting passing lanes and trying to win the ball back. I think Barcelona will have enough possession where they don't have to do that a lot of the time.
Yeah, I also kind of feel like if Pedri's in there in kind of the deeper roles, you don't necessarily need such a creative presence in the 10 because Pedri's able to kind of do everything from the base of the midfield, right? And the way that he gets the ball and pushes it into those areas often opens up space for Lamine Yamal, for Rafinha, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas I think without him in there, perhaps you do need a little bit more of a string puller. So perhaps it also is about the balance. Just a few words on Frenkie de Jong, because it was a bit of a strange game. He got a relatively early booking, and we talked about the fact that Barcelona didn't have the control that they normally have. And yet, every time I kind of looked up and gave this 5 minutes, you know, as a switching between the games, Frenkie de Jong for me felt like the best player on the pitch. And I know that sounds weird because Serge Gyarassi got a hat trick, but the control that he exuded at points when things started to get really hairy for Barcelona, I do think was important. And also, he really feels like he is growing into that number six role under Hansi Flick.
I think it's a different number six role under Flick than it was under Xavi.
Yeah.
And even potentially Valverde. I mean, how many managers has Frenkie de Jong played under at Barcelona? It seems like too many. But I think what Flick has, he's basically cemented Frenkie de Jong to say, sit here, control the game. Whereas under Xavi and previous managers, he was viewed as more of a ball carrier, right? Yeah. And that would leave open spaces. Whereas if Frenkie de Jong is just sitting in front of that back four, seeing, you know, patrolling that midfield area, breaking up passes, breaking up attacks, and just controlling that game, I think it suits him more because it doesn't ask a lot of him. And he's able to, he's got phenomenal composure. I think that's one thing we forgot. I think that's one thing that we forgot when he was basically trying to figure out where he fits in this Barcelona team. So many different iterations of managers coming in at different styles. We didn't know what his best position was. We didn't know whether he was a six or an eight. Under Flick, I think he's made it very simple. You're going to sit here. You're going to help Pedri, sit deep. You're going to clean stuff up. You're going to control the game, and that's it. You don't need to worry about pushing the ball forward. We've got other players for that, especially with the two outlets on the wings. You don't need to carry the ball up to them. Just shoot it out to them, and they'll take it. So I think this version of Frenkie de Jong is probably the best we've seen since he came to Barcelona. I will say maybe his first year at Barcelona was very impressive. Now, again, that had Lionel Messi. But I think this might be the best Frenkie de Jong we've seen at Barcelona. And it's probably the most defensive Frenkie de Jong we've seen, which is probably a good thing at this point in his career.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's always been interesting. I mean, he's such a wonderful ball carrier. And I think that was always a strength. The problem is that physically, he often felt like every time he went on a ball carry, he would leave wide open spaces. Now, Ajax were brilliant at actually filling those gaps. And Lasse Schürrle, for example, stepping in there and making things happen, the defense stepping out. It felt like there was cover for him to kind of do what he wanted. But that doesn't always affect how, you know, a team plays. Whilst it might be a strength of his, you need him to kind of fit into a system. And I think that whilst there is a freedom to the way that the front four play under Hansi Flick in this Barcelona side and the directness with which they approach games, it does feel like quite a lot of the middle bit has to be structured in order for everyone else to play the games. And maybe that doesn't include a Frenkie de Jong going on marauding runs through the center of midfield. And actually, I think that perhaps when you're looking at it now, you're thinking, well, maybe the opportunity here is for you to, you know, develop other skill sets, and you can still be press resistant. You can still move around players and get those passes off. You just don't need to run 35 yards with the ball in order to actually find those spaces. So I think you're probably right in terms of where he's at. But I do enjoy seeing Frenkie back playing at a really, really high level after a couple of difficult years. Let's just flip to Dortmund quickly, because it's been a pretty dreadful season from their perspective in the Bundesliga. Now, there have been high points, and their adventures in Europe have again kind of papered over the cracks a little bit of relatively poor domestic campaign. Now, they're back in the conversation in terms of European football next year. Now, whether they can claw back a Champions League place, I think feels like a little bit of a stretch, but we shall see. See, Niko Kovac took over from Nuri Sahin a couple of months ago now at this point, but he's found it quite hard to kind of impose a style upon this Borussia Dortmund team and impose kind of a feeling that things were moving in the right direction. But two really good results here in a row, a fight back against Bayern in the Clásica and then a 3-1 win at home over Barcelona, even if it wasn't enough to turn the tide on its head. There's a brilliant article from a friend of both of us, Sebastian Stafford-Bloor in the Athletic, someone we both worked with for a while, about basically Borussia Dortmund's identity and how they'd lost it both on and off the pitch and what it looked like. One of the things that I have kind of noticed in these two games is that Borussia Dortmund feel like if they don't have an identity quite yet again, they are working towards one. And whether that, you know, this was obviously three at the back with wing backs, etc., whether that's going to be something that the Westfalenstadion and this wonderful fan base will accept when they're playing against teams who are of a lower caliber than Barcelona or Bayern Munich, I don't quite yet know. But at least in today's performance and in the performance against Bayern, you're seeing kind of signs of, okay, we want to be direct. We want to get in behind. We want to utilize the ability that Gerassi and Bayer and Adeyemi have. We have the players to play three at the back, which might just settle us down a little bit in terms of some of the defensive issues that have plagued us all season. This has felt like a big week for Borussia Dortmund, even if they have ended up drawing one game and then being knocked out with a win in the other.
Well, I want to ask you a question here because I don't know the answer. But with Dortmund's unique sporting structure, you know, it's very much seen as a selling club. Develop young players, sell them off. Does that have anything to do with them lacking an identity because it's such a revolving door of managers and players? And it seems like players are getting sold every year, bringing in young players. And while it's nice to have these young, exciting players and develop them and see what they can do, it's tough to keep that identity when things are constantly changing, especially at a sporting level where, you know, you don't know what players are going to be here next year. So are these players that played well against Barcelona seem to have somewhat of a winning formula or at least a successful formula? Are they going to be around? My question to you is how much of Dortmund's sporting structure is result of their lack of identity?
Well, I think what's interesting is that that in itself was an identity. And actually, Borussia Dortmund had moved a little bit away from that, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, we saw Erling Haaland leave and we saw Jude Bellingham leave. But this was a club that has had players coming through, you know, a kind of rotating conveyor belt for such a long time. And it almost felt like after those two left, they were like, right, we need to stop doing this because we're losing all of these players. We need to stop being a stepping stone club. And that meant a kind of change in strategy. You kind of saw players coming in, Valdemar Anton, Serhu Girassi, players who'd done well for other Bundesliga sides. It felt a little bit Bayern Munich light, right? In the, you know, we used to always kind of joke about the fact that Bayern used to just buy all the best players in the Bundesliga and they would just all play for Bayern and then they'd win the league. But Borussia Dortmund went for a little bit of that strategy. And I wonder if that's actually set them back a little bit because, you know, when you have these kind of younger, hungrier players coming through, they're playing for a future. They're playing for these big moves. And you don't get a big move by finishing eighth in the Bundesliga, right? You get a big move by challenging for titles. You get a big move by putting yourself deep in competitions where there are going to be eyeballs on you. And whilst that might not have been the best strategy from a kind of long-term Dortmund perspective, I think it's worth probably pointing out that since they've shifted away from that, you're getting players who come in and go, oh, I'm at Borussia Dortmund now. I've reached the pinnacle that I'm probably going to get to. And there is maybe a little bit less of that kind of feeling of excitement around certain players as they move through. So I wonder if there is a strategy kind of forming here that whilst they don't necessarily need to go back all the way 100%, it's maybe just wind it back a little bit. And I think obviously Jamie Gittins is someone who's attracted a lot of attention. I think that they will feel a little bit different in terms of the way that they go about their business. I don't think they're going to be buying, you know, maybe the best players that they would seeing everywhere. I think they will be now looking at saying, okay, come in and play for Dortmund for 5 years. Don't come in here for the kind of quick fixes. And we've seen that with certain players who I think are starting to make the grade now. You know, it took a little bit of time for Julian Duranville, who I think was the first Belgian player that they ever signed, to kind of come through and start to make a mark. But I thought he was excellent when he came off the bench tonight. It was nice to see Gio Reyna get an appearance in this game after he's just bounced around forever, not really feeling like he belongs. But I think Bayer is a good example where they've bought a player who is someone who's still young and exciting from the Bundesliga when they brought him in from Hoffenheim, but not someone who's going to be like, this is potentially the peak of my career. And it's about finding that balance where players want to come and play for the club, but also have that hunger to prove themselves and continue to develop. And I think that's maybe a little bit of what Borussia Dortmund have been missing of late.
It's so weird to say that Erling Haaland and Jude Bellingham have done more damage to Dortmund in the past 3 years, pretty much, because I think they've altered the perception of what the club is and kind of how they want to go about business, especially players as well, because players will now come to Dortmund and think they can burst onto the scene like those two players. Whereas maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it took 4 or 5 years for these players to become those players to then go on and move to Bayern or wherever. Yeah. Whereas now players coming in see themselves as a Haaland or a Bellingham, and they want that instant impact and that instant, okay, 2 years from now, I'm going to go for 100 million. That may have done more damage to the footballing structure than we know. Because like you said, they adjusted their structure because they wanted to get away from that feeder system and that selling club. Maybe they need to find that balance, as you mentioned, pull back a little bit, but not maybe go back all the way. It's about finding that balance of, okay, we can still bring in young talent, but maybe players that want to be a part of a 4 or 5 year project and then move on, not be that
quick fixes.
Right? Exactly.
I think you're bang on. I also think the other thing that's interesting with this, and it kind of happens to all of these clubs, you know, you see it a little bit with Brighton, for example, at the moment, in that once you get those fees, you know, you think about over a period of what, 5 years, they sell Ousmane Dembele for an outrageous fee to Barcelona. They sell Erling Haaland for a less outrageous, but still pretty big fee to Manchester City. And they sell Jude Bellingham for sort of the 100 million mark to Real Madrid. Well, the next moment that Dortmund go out and go, okay, we're going to spot a young talent, then someone goes, yeah, all right, 20 million. And then suddenly that's a very different ball game when that person comes in, because there's pressure and expectation upon them than it was the first time around. And I think that that's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy at some point. You know, it gets stuck in the cycle where you then have to pay more for young players. Therefore, the pressure is higher. Therefore, they might not deliver. Therefore, they get frustrated because they're not making the impact they make. It just feels like one of those things where Borussia Dortmund need a kind of reset from the top. But equally, I do think that Niko Kovac, who I wasn't completely convinced was going to be the answer to Borussia Dortmund's problems, it felt like a bit of a stopgap to the end of the season, seems to have just steadied the ship enough for the time being. We'll see how he gets on for the rest of the campaign.
Would you give him a chance next season?
I mean, I think that they can wait on this, right? They don't have to make a decision on this right now. They can sit here and go, okay, do we get back into, let's just say, the Europa League? I think the Champions League is going to be a stretch from a Borussia Dortmund perspective, considering where they are in the Bundesliga table. It's not impossible, but I think it's going to be very, very difficult for them to kind of overhaul where, you know, the team's in there right now, especially considering it's only four places. The only reason they're back in the Champions League is because it was five places last year. Now, the idea that Dortmund might overhaul Mainz, who are 4 points ahead of them, doesn't seem that ridiculous in some ways, but that's only to get to fifth. Are they going to get to Leipzig, who, you know, are 6 points ahead of them at this point, considering the seasons they've had? Again, not impossible, but potentially feels like a bit of a stretch. So it's going to see, let's see where they get to. If they get a Europa League place, that might be a good spot for Borussia Dortmund to be, because, you know, you're looking at a team that want to go out and reestablish themselves as one of the biggest names in European football. They have such an iconic stadium. They have such an iconic colorway. All of these things matter. But I think that also going and winning a trophy, even if it is a step down to go to the Europa League, might just be something that Borussia Dortmund can hang their hat on for a season that would just maybe elevate things back to, we're a club that goes and wins trophies. This is a good place to be. And it hasn't been that for a little while.
They also need some sort of stability, whether that's at the managerial position, whether that's part of the roster. There needs to be, like, you can't keep changing structure and strategy and managers and expect success. There needs to be some sort of stability. And in order to give that a chance, I do think you need to bring him back next year, at least just see. And like you said, you don't need to make a decision now. We're mid-April. We still have some time. There is no pressure right now. But I do think there is benefit of having some stability and some focus on, okay, this is this person's team, or this is this person's team, and this is their identity, instead of just going through a carousel of different people. It's just, you're not going to find a winning formula that way. We've seen it with Barcelona in the past, with trying to, and that was a financial issue as well, though, but bringing in different managers, bringing in different players, trying out, you're not going to win without some sort of stability, whether that's from the way top or the managerial position.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Well, best of luck to Barcelona and PSG, our first two Champions League semi-finalists, and hard luck to Aston Villa and Borussia Dortmund, who both gave very, very good accounts of themselves in the Champions League on Tuesday night. We'll be back after Wednesday's action, looking at that game between Arsenal and Real Madrid and between Inter and Bayern Munich. But for now, all that's left for me to do is say a massive, massive thank you to the wonderful Mike Zimmerman for stepping in on Champions League Takeaway. Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Always a pleasure, Jack. Really appreciate you.
Thank you, mate. I've been Jack Collins. This has been Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever, and we'll see you shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.